Well, dude, are you in Wyoming?
Yeah, I'm in. Well, right now I'm in San Diego at my parents' house. But normally I live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. So I've been there for 6 years or so.
Oh, gotcha. What led you there? Because I was looking at your LinkedIn, and I saw you spent some time in California. And
yeah,
then clearly, like, you went to what? Was it just you wanted to get off the grid a little bit?
Kind of, yeah. I grew up in San Diego and then went to Stanford and then spent, you know, 8 years in San Francisco after that, which was super fun. But yeah, we just felt like we were ready to graduate and kind of narrowed it down to mountain towns. And Jackson Hole is pretty sweet if you're like a skier, but it's also super fun in the summer with like fishing and biking and stuff. So we loved it. And now our headquarters,
cool. Yeah.
We have six people there and we're doing our first all company offsite with 25 people in Jackson next week, which will be pretty fun. And we'll do some cowboy shit and rodeo and all that.
I love that. So do you recruit like locally then?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of like really smart people that just kind of went out there to, you know, be ski bums or whatever. And then after, mm-hmm. you know, 4 years of doing that, like they kind of, you know, get the itch to have more of a career, but they still want to stay in Jackson. So yeah, there's obviously a finite, there's only 10,000 people, so there's a finite limit, but like there's some really good people there that are just hanging out in Jackson that are smart.
That's cool. One of my best friends is kind of doing that same thing in Utah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting life for sure.
You can have both now. We can have fulfilling velocitous tech careers and live in cool places. So it's possible.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny too, because, you know, when after I graduated and, you know, my wife and I got married, the first thing we did, we were like, all right, we got to get out of Michigan. We didn't really go as far as like, you know, a San Francisco or anything like that. We felt like Vancouver, Washington was like a good, like middle ground for like, okay, we have access to a bigger city, like with Portland. But we can still kind of like retreat back to like a smaller kind of town.
Yeah, that's a good happy medium for sure. Is, you know, access to both is cool for sure.
Well, that's the other thing that I wanted to chat about, right? Because you spent some time, obviously you in San Diego, and you were also working for a while, at SurveyMonkey. You were doing a bunch of sales type roles, but then you pivoted and you started a company. I feel like you don't normally see that, like someone who has like an extensive kind of like sales career and then goes and jumps into starting a company. Is that like, what changed for you to go and start User Evidence?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like I always wanted to start a company and be an entrepreneur. I just didn't know what the heck to do. And then neglected to get technical skills in college, because at the time when I graduated in 2010, I was an econ major. So like finance and consulting was the cool thing to do. And so like I got my suit and like did some interviews and like, this sucks. but at the time, like my buddies were just starting to do startups. Like one of my roommates was the co-founder of Snapchat. The guy down the hall did
really?
Robinhood, like the stock trading app.
Oh my God.
I wish I would have invested in an index fund for my hallway. It would have been productive. But yeah, but I mean, at the time, obviously they were super small. I was like, oh, that looks fun. Like they're kind of hanging out with their buddies, you know, making shit, and they don't have to wear suits, which is great. But yeah, anyway, so I always had that in my background. I got into sales. You know, I was the first salesperson at this company called TechValidate, built it to like 13 million a year, was acquired by SurveyMonkey. And then, yeah, eventually just became like an enterprise rep, which is what allowed me to move out to Jackson, which was great. I made tons of money, but it wasn't particularly intellectually interesting because it was just easy. And so that's when I, you know, kind of came back to like, all right, you know, is there something we can start? And I picked an area, customer marketing, that I knew pretty well. And then it was just iterative from there. You just, you know, I made a deck, I made a kind of Figma clickable prototype, started showing it to some people, got some good feedback, got some seed checks. And yeah, you know, it wasn't like a particular moment. You just kind of keep making progress and eventually make enough progress where you have a real company.
No, that's fascinating. Well, number one, the thing that you just said, sales, you're making a ton of money, but it was easy. I feel like some people might disagree with you there. Did you really find like it was truly easy, or like, had you just gotten to the point where you had just like done so many, like logged in so many hours doing like sales that you just found it easy at one point, and plus you had a good product, or what was it?
Very strong expertise in what I was selling. And so there's a lot of, you know, today's environment is probably much harder. I mean, not like selling today is hard. I was at the good confluence of like right product, right time, and I had strong expertise in it. So it was easy for me at the time. It would not say sales is easy generally, though. Right now it's freaking hard, man. It's selling tech to tech companies and go to market tech is no easy task in this market. So
are you still the main salesperson for User Evidence today?
You know, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, no. I go on paternity leave like October 30th, so I will kind of by definition have to not be by then. I probably make the mistake as a founder of being too close to sales just because I love it and it's fun. And it's cool to it's nice to talk to customers every day because I think it informs, building good product that's going to deliver revenue. But no, that's what I'm really trying to work on, scaling myself out of being an individual seller and even down level manager of individual reps, because, obviously that doesn't scale. So, but it's hard for me. I fucking love selling.
When I was at Zoom Info, I found that, Henry, the CEO there, he was very close to sales and he was very much like a seller at heart. And when I moved to ClickUp, it was the other way. Like Zeb was a builder and he helped build the product and he was very close to the product side. And so I find that it's so interesting how, just kind of depending on the background, where some of the founders end up leaning more towards, on the tactical side of things. Honestly, yeah. I feel like it's still I could see you still doing great in terms of doing kind of the founder sales tech, especially as you were previously a seller. I feel like that really adds to, the buying experience.
Totally. Yeah. And for us, probably all we'll always be sales led. I mean, we might have some product led component for lead gen, but we're higher ACV enterprise solutions. So that works versus, ClickUp, which is very much a product led company,
Totally.
Probably much more of an advantage to have a product led founder, right? Zoom Info is obviously very sales led.
right.
So yeah, I think it, founder market fit and founder go to market style fit is important, and leaning into what you do well is good too. So makes sense.
Yeah. Well, tell me about User Evidence. I know that the 10,000 foot view is that it automates social proof for go to market teams, but tell me the how and the why, and why you felt like this was the right thing for you to build.
Yeah. I mean, so I was a seller, right, for a long time. And, I was at a good company, SurveyMonkey, that had resources and stuff like that. And they did a great job, marketing team, of doing the high production big stories. Here's how Warby Parker uses SurveyMonkey. And they looked awesome. The challenge was, though, we had four products and I had 16 different industries of people that I sold to. So I was that Warby Parker story is awesome. But I have a financial services company that's trying to buy this product. Do you have any stories around that? And they're like, well, no, we only have four of them, but they look really, really good. I was like, but wait, we have 10,000 customers. So why do we only have four stories? And, the problem that, so if you're a B2B company that, has a big customer base and that's diverse across industries and stuff, and especially if you sell to larger enterprises, it's really hard to get case studies and stories, and, bigger companies don't want to go on the record because of legal and PR. And even when they do, it's a pain in the ass to interview them and get approvals and have designers turn it into content. So you get this problem where there's this shortage of customer proof, which might sound like, there's holes in the library of stories, or we need more statistical evidence to back up claims around, ROI or time savings, or we need more in the Zoom Info world, we need more competitive evidence. Why are people switching from Gong, or in the ClickUp world, why are we better than Asana? And there's just a huge shortage there. And the insight was this asset that people have, which is, in ClickUp's case and Zoom Info's, tens of thousands of happy users, but we're only telling stories from 3%, right? And so the idea was, how can we, analogous to how, Marketo and Pardot enabled one-to-many marketing automation and outreach and sales loft enabled one-to-many sales communication, how could we use that same one-to-many concept, but in customer marketing, to do customer content creation and story creation at scale? That was kind of how the idea originally came up.
That makes a ton of sense. And I can speak, I've said in the past that I feel like customer testimonials and case studies are honestly the best competitive assets that you can create, even if they're not switcher stories. If you can just say hey, we solved the problem that you are experiencing, and we did it with a company that looks very similar to you, then sometimes you don't even need to mention the actual competitor or that the fact that the company switched or anything like that. But there's always such a shortage, like you mentioned, of actual case studies that match, the companies that you're speaking to. It's very unfortunate.
Yeah. And then the modern tool set available to solve this problem now is pretty cool. It's things like surveys can obviously capture feedback at scale. And now we have a lot of good kind of design automation capabilities with Canva-esque, you know, capabilities and AI even. So, you know, capturing large data and then creating really elegant, cool looking branded content is kind of what we're all about. But yeah, to your point, it's like, it's like we're in a bunch, we're in some competitive scenarios right now. And it's obviously awkward as a salesperson to be like, you know, we're better than the competitor, because even if you have the coolest feature matrix and whatever, it just feels weird, right? You're like,
it does.
It's awkward to say, like, imagine I'm the coolest person ever. It just doesn't sound good. Well, right?
Yeah. And the other piece too is like all those like feature comparisons or matrices, they lack a narrative or a story, which is what people like really latch onto in the first place. And so, yeah, you can send over these, you know, very black and white kind of, I don't know, like feature comparisons, or you can have landing pages or whatever that kind of like, it's you telling your story. That's okay to some degree. Like, I think that you should have like kind of a basic understanding of like how a product stacks up against somebody else. Absolutely. But the customer story, that's really when things I feel like truly land with somebody else. And it's very much customer centric. You know what I mean? It's not about you. It's about, hey, this person's succeeding, and hey, they just so happen to be using your product.
Yeah. And I think especially in today's market, like, you know, the feature comparison, for instance, is a component of the broader argument on why you're the right choice. And if you think about it, you know, usually like decision-making circles that you're selling to could be 2, 3, 4, or 5 people. That marketing ops person, for instance, might need a more technical comparison on how it integrates and stuff like that. But, you know, your executive sponsor might need more of like an executive level colorful story on why you switched. That having the full complement of assets for a sales team when it comes to competitive, you know, just so you have the right mix to deliver, I think is important for sure.
I haven't seen another platform like User Evidence either. So I feel like, you know, your primary competitors are really just spend on other platforms that people might use for testimonials, like a G2 Trust Radius, or like if they're really trying to expand on like an NPS survey through like, I don't know, one of those kind of tools, like in-app kind of tool, like Pendo or something.
Pendo or something, yeah, sure.
So where does User Evidence fit in? Because I know that also it's important, like those tools are where you might capture some testimonials. So how do you fit in? Like, who are your main competitors and how do you kind of differentiate?
Yeah, that's been tricky for us. I mean, in theory, it sounds, you know, nice to be like, oh yeah, like, you know, we don't have any direct competitors. And that's true in the sense that we don't get the like, hey, competitor X is charging us, you know, 15% less, so lower your price or we're going with them. The downside of that is like, you know, it's not a super defined space, and defined spaces are nice because, like, you know, if I need a CRM, I'm just going to, those vendors all get a ton of inbound and they're going to purchase something. You just need to prove that you're better. So we have this more amorphous, abstract challenge of like, you know, how do we fit in amongst a bunch of tangent solutions that are also kind of attacking the problem from different angles, which is tricky. Sometimes you'll get evaluations that are, you know, pretty nuanced and they have a good understanding, you know, how is this different than, you know, another survey tool like Qualtrics that we're using to capture feedback. And sometimes you'll get one that are just like really abstract and broad. You're like, how is this different than, you know, this email tool I have? Cause they both have an email component to it. And you're like, all right, gosh, we have a long way to go on that one. But, you know, for us, we've carved out this space where it's, yes, feedback is critical, not just for the purpose of creating cool content and testimonials and case studies. Obviously that's the main use case for us, but feedback should be very important to a variety of functions, from, you know, competitive intelligence to account management and customer success to product. And right now what we see is like these approaches are all very siloed. Like, you reach out to go do G2 reviews, and if you hit negative people, who cares? They're not going to leave positive reviews, and that's not what we're looking for. Similarly, if you do a product management survey and you get a bunch of positive stuff, the product manager is like, all right, cool, that's good to know, I'm building a great product, but that never makes it into the hands of the marketing team. And so you get like 7 different outreaches to customers, and if it doesn't fit their purpose, it's discarded. And so eventually, like, we're striving to encourage companies to kind of unify the collection and then serve it up in different ways for different functions in the company that might use that customer feedback in different ways. And that is new. There's not a ton of stuff that's doing that right now. So it's got challenges on it, but I think it's a big opportunity if we can get it right.
This episode of the Healthy Competition Podcast is brought to you by the Healthy Competition Community. Whoa, can you believe that? The Healthy Competition Community is where product marketers, competitive intel practitioners, and other go-to-market pros share best practices and act as a sounding board for questions that Google can't answer. Over 1,000 messages are exchanged every month, despite there being less than 100 members in the community. Now, I'm a firm believer in prioritizing high-quality topics of conversation and building authentic connections over member count numbers. So this piece is super important to me. But with that being said, if you listen to this podcast, then you'll probably love being in the community. So join today at healthycompetition.co. That's healthycompetition.co. Now, back to the episode.
It's kind of like an all-in-one strategy a little bit. You know, you're taking like pieces of let me take a step back, where you might not be, you know, specifically replacing one tool, but you're kind of becoming like the hub where everyone can kind of manage that flow of gathering stories or gathering testimonials, and you're not just having to jump through into all these different channels, managing them in kind of like their own specific way. You know, that can waste a ton of time and resources, and people, you know, I might not know how to use like Appendo, but like, hey, I have an admin license for G2, but hey, our customer marketing manager has the admin license for Trust Radius. And so you might have to ping her for some, you know what I mean? So I feel like that could be the big salt.
It is. Yeah. So like, and Appendo is a customer of ours, right? And so what their technology does, they're very good at, you know, popping up a pop-up at the relevant time. And then if it's a happy customer, it leads out to user evidence survey so they can turn that happy story into content. You know, for G2, we're working on partnerships where we can actually ingest the vendors, all their reviews from G2, and turn it into much prettier content, and also source positive reviews out to G2. So yeah, we're trying to figure out, you know, a lot of these people we want to integrate with, you know, down market eventually. Like I do think like in this environment, there's an appetite to want to consolidate tech stacks a little bit and have less complexity and less spend, of course. And I think we'll lean into that, but it's tricky. As a small company, you know, we're not Clary or Gong where we're going to, you know, have 5,000 people and $200 million to go take over the world. So how do you accomplish that kind of, you know, kill three or four birds with one stone, more of an all-in-one platform as a small company where you have limited resource and focuses? So that's been a tricky evolution for us, but I think we've been very intentional about, you know, at least starting with our wedge of product marketing and customer marketing people. But, you know, the broader narrative around how feedback impacts multiple functions is starting to resonate a lot more, and our customers are pushing us in that direction. So we will expand, which will take us into new, you know, competitive territory.
What's next for user evidence? Like what are the big plays, and where do you see the company like in the next year? Like I saw that you just hired Mark from Metadata. He's an incredible marketer. And so no pun intended, but in either case, you know, so I saw your new website. You have a great rebrand that you just rolled out. Super exciting. So what are some big goals that you're hoping to hit in the next year?
Yeah. So we just hired, you know, a bunch of new executive leadership. Mark's been freaking awesome. The new website looks great. I have a new VP of sales starting in early September. We had a new VP of success start a couple months ago. So a lot of it's just like now preparing for scale. You know, we have good product market fit. You know, we have 100 really awesome customers and with big names like, you know, Gong and Splunk and F5 and Pendo and Mercado and people like that. But yeah, what we're trying to do is go from, you know, 3 million in ARR to 9 or 10 next year, which is significantly more difficult than going from 1 to 3. So it's just a huge step up in complexity from an operations perspective and scaling the go-to-market efforts, which is fun and interesting. But yeah, you know, there's also just a bunch of new product efforts to take us into, you know, just selling right now primarily to product marketing and customer marketing, into a broader go-to-market team, you know, sales and sales enablement, account management and CS, product management to an extent, Marcom. So leaning into this vision of, you know, customer insights should impact every function in the company that touches customers is kind of the next evolution. A big area for growth right now is the larger enterprise segment. So, you know, doing multiple $100,000s of deals with companies like Cisco and Salesforce and Dell and IBM. So a lot of that larger enterprise segment is a good focus for us as well.
At what point did you realize that product marketing was a great persona for you? Because, you know, I totally agree, right? Customer marketing, that makes sense. They're typically the ones that are handling, you know, the case studies, testimonials, and all that good stuff. But, you know, as we've been talking and as I was digging into user evidence, you know, doing my research, I was able to see kind of how product marketing would be another great term, but it wasn't like the first thing that I thought of. So like, was that something that you discovered along the way when you were building?
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, a lot of our, you know, what we're creating is customer stories, and obviously that screams, you know, customer marketing, right? But when you kind of think about it, it's like, all right, yes, that function, customer marketing, is supposed to be developing customer stories, and they are, but they're just doing the one-to-one kind of traditional case studies, and the people that are suffering, it's not them, they're just doing their job. People that are suffering are the consumers of that content that don't have, you know, stories in a certain industry or don't have good competitive evidence, or they need more statistical proof to validate claims from a product marketing perspective. So, you know, we actually found that like product marketing is a really good kind of centralized hub between all those consuming functions like enablement and demand gen and competitive. And customer marketing is one of the ones that are responsible for creation, but product marketing had a better view of the overall picture of how evidence and content gets delivered across these channels, because they say they're doing a product launch, they know the messaging and positioning, they're responsible for seeing that DTM effort through to launch. And they know, it's like, all right, we have like, great, we have a product launch coming up, we have no customers to put in the press release or in any of the follow-up go-to-market stuff after. That's a problem for product marketing.
Oh my God.
They're also really used to like spending money on content generation, like in analyst reports and white papers and stuff like that. So it's a good budget center for us as well.
Yeah, that makes sense too, especially because, like, you know, I can speak from experience. There have been times where I will be like leading a launch and it'll just kind of come to like the 11th hour. You know, there might be like a week or 2 weeks left and I'll realize like, oh God, we need a customer testimonial. And that's like way too late to bring in like a customer marketer and to like try to get
a normal cycle. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I feel like that does make a lot more sense to just like kind of combine that on. And that plus the fact that I think typically customer marketing is in the same team or department as product marketing. And so totally, like they just work so closely together anyway. Right. So it makes sense.
Yeah. At a smaller company, most of the time they don't have customer marketing, and that's just one job that the product marketer has to do that they probably don't put enough time into, don't really get to it.
Right.
So yeah, at the smaller end, we help down there. And then, you know, a bigger company of like take Salesforce, for instance, they have 50 customer marketers, which you think would be, you know, more than enough people to get the job done. But at the same token, they have 27 product groups they have to support. And each of those products has, you know, 8 competitors in 17 different industries. So it's just the magnitude of the problem is pretty intense, and even they need help. So.
Yeah. The last piece that I wanted to mention, this jumped out to me as I was just kind of like looking at like some of your messaging. And I don't know if you created this, but I hadn't read it this way before, but it's evidence-based marketing, just like as like a almost like a category in itself. And again, like I know that, like I think I've heard that somewhere before, right? Evidence-based marketing, but this was the first time that I'd really seen it from like a tech perspective or like a vendor actually using that. And it was just so refreshing to me. So I was just wondering, is that something that, is that like an official kind of a like tagline or category or subcategory that you're moving towards, or is that just really good copy?
Yeah. I'm not a category expert at all. I had something I had thought about when I made the company, actually. I was like, I like this tagline. I'd like it to be something, whether or not it will, who knows. But, you know, the way I buy products, at least, like, you know, I'm fairly analytical minded and, you know, I'm just trying to figure out if the thing's going to work for me. And so the best way to do that is to get a decent approximation of that they have a bunch of customers that look like me, same size, same use case. And if I have confidence that they've delivered for those type of customers, that gives me good confidence. And so, yeah, I think it was a response to today's, like, there's so much freaking noise out there just because there's so many damn vendors saying, you know, we can make it faster, save time, save money and stuff like that, that I think the antidote to all that noise and just claims being thrown out about is just authentic evidence-based marketing, just real stories from people so that you can just tell someone, you know, give someone confidence that you've worked with someone that looks like them, I think is really what it comes down to.
Okay, let's wrap up. I have one last question. If you had to like just share one of your biggest learnings since starting user evidence, whether that's, you know, from just like a building perspective, like how products work, or if it's like just a realization that you came to with the audiences that you're selling and marketing to. Would love to kind of hear your perspective on just like the one huge takeaway that you would impart on somebody else who might be trying to sell into the same space.
I think one thing I'm very fortunate and I'm glad we did is like we asked for money right away, even from like alpha and beta customers, and like said, like if we could do this, would you pay, you know, $20,000 or whatever it is? And that friction early, I think, prepared us for this market now. Like I've made some investment in some companies that, you know, kind of started off product led growth and they got a bunch of users, but because there wasn't that like big dollar friction, like they got some like false positive signal, which allowed them to keep going, maybe even raise that first round. But now they're in trouble where it's like, crap, like I can't get big dollars because I'm not solving like a concrete enough problem in this market that people aren't going to buy shit unless there's a freaking concrete critical problem. And so and the earlier you can figure that out as an entrepreneur, so you're not spinning and just getting users and stuff like that, I think is, at least for, you know, a B2B oriented, you know, enterprise startup, like that was one of my biggest learnings. And now we've, you know, revolved a lot of our sales process a lot around that, just figuring out quickly, like, does there a problem that freaking matters at the executive level? Otherwise, we have like really cool tools and technology that looks fun, but, you know, isn't going to attach to a critical initiative over there.
Well, how did you make that work though for those alpha and beta customers too? Because, you know, such a big value prop for user evidence is to, you know, share customer stories. But when you're in that early stage, you don't have many customer stories. And so how were you able to get that over the line?
Yeah. I mean, we de-risked it, of course, and said, if it wouldn't work, we'll give you your money back and all that. But I also think like it, you know, it communicates the right value to your customers, assuming you're selling at the right level. Like we had to get, you know, of course, director and VP level people on the phone to accomplish this, but, you know, them paying money is a good proxy for, does this solve a big problem? And if we're not, then like, we don't want to be working there. Right. So I think it accomplished a lot of things. You know, yes, it was tricky and it, you know, we obviously wanted to just get some initial deals done to get some of that initial support. And we were flexible. If they asked for discounts, whatever, like we'll do that because you got to get logos in the first year. But yeah, having some friction is healthy, I think.
Yeah. And I think that the other thing that you mentioned that stood out to me is just that prepared you for, you know, the selling environment that we're experiencing today. And it reminded me of something that I read a couple of months ago where it was talking about how it's actually the earlier stage companies right now who are better set up than those companies that have raised like their like $100 million series A, B, C, and are like these multi-billion-dollar valuations. Like those companies are actually going to be struggling the most right now. A lot of them are underwater and are not very, they don't have a very efficient business. And so that's another thing that I'm sure, you know, you've set yourself up pretty well for.
Yeah. I mean, if you grow up in hard times, you know, that's a, you know, you're swinging the heavy bat, right? That's a good environment to grow up in and instills the right discipline. You know, if you grow up in easy times, you're, you know, used to easier selling, you're used to capital being always there. So yeah, those kind of mid-stage startup series BC that raised, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah. It'll be tricky, but even like the seed startups, like I invested in I had three investments go out of business this year, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
And because like what I invested in, just given my network, tends to be like good markety technology, you know, cool sales tools that are like, oh, that's sweet. And a lot of that stuff, it is super cool. And like, you know, especially with AI and stuff, like demos really well. But then you're thinking about it, you're just like, all right, like, how's this move the needle on revenue again? And if there's not a clear answer there, then you're just like, this is cool technology. I'm not going to prioritize it. Right. So yeah, it's, for advice for entrepreneurs is, you know, make sure you understand the problem that you're solving before you build cool tech. Cause it is, you know, fun and attractive to build cool tech these days with all the fun stuff out there. So.
Was there any kind of pattern between those companies that went out of business? Was it just that they couldn't tie to revenue?
Yeah, they're all cool golden go-to-market stuff that you know, was interesting, but solved like third tangent problems that weren't core to getting more revenue. And
yeah,
probably should have thought about that ahead of time. But like, it's just, yeah, you know, as an early stage company, you got to be ruthless around picking a specific persona and understanding a concrete problem that they have. Because you're not Gong, you're not Clary, you're not going to do this all or one thing that looks cool on a VC pitch deck. You're just not going to accomplish that in the first couple of years.
Totally. All right, man. Well, Evan, this was awesome chatting with you and learning more about User Evidence. Where can people learn more about you or follow you and or User Evidence if they want to follow the journey?
Yeah, the website's pretty sweet now, www.userevidence.com. And then for me, I'm definitely on LinkedIn, Evan Huck. So hit me up there and I'll hit you back.
Awesome. Thanks again, dude.
Awesome. Good to catch up, Andy. Appreciate it.
Hey, you made it to the end of the episode. I have one small favor for you now. If you could please rate this podcast 5 stars wherever you're listening to it, that'd be super helpful for me. For Spotify, you can only leave a review on the mobile app, and you can do that on the top of the Healthy Competition podcast profile. And for Apple Podcasts, you have to scroll to the bottom of the show's page and click write a review. Each podcast episode takes about 5 hours of my time from beginning to end, while reviewing it should only take about 5 seconds of your time. Plus, you'd be making my day. So thank you so much in advance, and see you in the next episode.